You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
What really happened in Beirut? Yesterday, we followed the story as it was unfolding, this enormous, enormous explosion in the port of Beirut, Lebanon. 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate blew up. Now, officially, there are over 100 people killed. That will go up. The city's been almost devastated, destroyed. The pictures and the videos are extraordinary. 5, 10, 20 kilometers away, people were feeling the blast. Windows were blowing out. There's a two-week state of emergency declared by the Lebanese government. 5,000 people are wounded, plus, plus, plus. Hundreds of thousands have no place to live. And then the question is, what really happened? There's a lot of conspiracies out there. The government is saying that years ago, a Russian freighter dumped 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate, which is used in fertilizer, and they did not store it properly, and it combusted. Now, ammonium nitrate can be very stable if stored properly. If not, it can be very combustible. Remember, the Oklahoma bombing in the 90s, Timothy McVeigh, that killed over 160 Americans and wounded hundreds more, took down that building in Oklahoma. Remember that? 2 tons of ammonium nitrate. 2 tons. Killed hundreds. This is 2,700 tons. But what really happened? Let me bring in Nasir Yassin. He's a professor at the American University of Beirut. And Nasir, I hope you and your family are okay. Where were you during the explosion, sir?
Hi. I was leaving Beirut to the mountain, so like 20 kilometers outside Beirut, and we felt as if that explosion or bomb actually happening nearby. We didn't realize that this was in Beirut because it was so clear, it was so loud. And then we started to get the real story. I've lived my life as a kid in the civil war in Lebanon in the 1980s, and then I witnessed assassinations, street wars, Israeli war on Lebanon in 2006, and I haven't seen something that big, that devastating as I've seen in the bomb and the explosion last evening.
I've never seen anything like it either. This is beyond anything most cities have ever experienced. How can you give us a sense of how devastated Beirut is right now and the extent of the damage, Nasir?
So this happened, as you mentioned, in the main port of Lebanon. This is the port of Beirut, the main harbor. And, this gets around 75% of the imports come to this. So this is a strategic gateway to the world that has been almost totally destroyed by the explosion. So, in a radius of 3 kilometers, in almost all houses and buildings have been severely damaged. And then you can go up to 20 kilometers where many houses had their glasses broken, their furniture broken, and so on. So in a radius of perhaps around 5 kilometers, it looks like a war zone.
That's a massive area. I just want people, that here in Canada in 1917, we had the Halifax explosion. There was an explosion of a similar ship in 1947 in the U.S. This is almost unprecedented. Now, what is the human cost is incalculable in some ways, Nasir, but it's Lebanon, and you mentioned you've lived through civil wars, the Israeli war, the entrance of Hezbollah into the political situation there. There's so much chaos that has sort of destroyed Beirut from its sort of glory days in the 70s, but what is the political fallout of this? What are people saying? Was it just do people accept that this was just a badly stored Russian ammonium nitrate? Or, as I've heard, could it have been something else? Could it have been a munitions dump for somebody?
you know, I mean, there are a lot of stories about what triggered this, and we cannot tell. Mostly people speculating whether it was an attack, a deliberate thing, or it was an accident. But regardless of where this investigation will get us, what triggered this huge explosion, there are real and genuine and angry questions about what actually and why and what has led to leaving this huge amount of nitrates in a very strategic part of Lebanon, and it's in the heart of the city. I mean, how on earth someone would leave this huge amount of nitrates in the heart of Beirut for the last 6 years? I mean, it's not like for a month or two. It's been for 6 years without anyone asking a question about this. So the anger now is about the inability of the government, the inability of people in the administration to actually deal with such an issue. This now, negligence here is not something that's only, you know, leading to inefficiency. It's not only something related to corruption. This is now killing tens of hundreds of people and injuring thousands of people and destroying neighborhoods in the city. So people are angry about this, and they're demanding accountability. They want actually the government, and they want that such investigation to go up towards the top to actually get real answers. But, you know, I mean, the Lebanese have been taking it to the streets for the last 9 months in terms of demonstrations and protest movement, and it hasn't led to real reform or real change. And I think now this incident is going to bring people back into the street demanding more, you know, governance, more better governance and better reforms.
Yeah, but boy, in the meantime, you've got an economy crashing, you've got COVID-19, now you've got the capital city essentially leveled, and then you've got the political instability there, and I wonder who, you know, is it Beirut's governor, is it the prime minister? You just don't know, but in the meantime, I'm sure everybody knows someone who was wounded by this explosion.
Absolutely. I mean, we've been getting all these stories and texts and news about people whom we know have been lost or not accounted yet or injured or unfortunately passing away and due to this explosion. But you know, this is going to be, it's the straw in the back of Lebanon, I'm putting it this way. Lebanon has been going through a major economic crisis, quite severe and deep, where people lost 70 to 80% of their purchasing power, of the level of their income because of the fall of and the collapse of the local currency. And then COVID-19 came in, and then this huge incident in terms of, you know, the direct impact and the repercussions. So there are questions that we're posing now about food security. I mean, how are we going to get food and grain to the country when the main port has been destroyed and leveled down to the earth?
Well, those are key questions. How that infrastructure
will get better.
Yeah, we hope. We hope. Nasser Yassin, a professor at the American University of Beirut, sir, I hope you and your family stay safe. It's going to be very difficult times ahead. Take good care, and I appreciate you joining us. We've got to take a very, very short break, but we'll continue on this, get more answers on what could have happened there and the fallout in the explosion in Beirut.
From coast to coast to coast, the newsmakers talk here. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. We are focused on this massive explosion in Beirut, Lebanon. The cause of it is undetermined. Was it? How did this 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate used in fertilizer, usually stable, stored in the port, explode and level the city of Beirut, killing 100, injuring 5,000? The videos are shocking. You see the smoke, people are videoing, and then the blast. It's devastating. Here's what it sounds like in one of those videos. then it's like a shockwave. The shockwave just levels buildings for 3, 4, 5 kilometers. They're felt at 20 kilometers away. Then yesterday, speculating on this, I don't know where he got this information, but he is the president of the United States, so we got to consider it. Donald Trump said, no. This is not just a situation where there was ammonium nitrate taken off a Russian freighter 6 or 7 years ago, stored stupidly in the port of Beirut, and it exploded. No. Something more sinister is afoot. Here's Donald Trump.
You called this an attack. Are you confident that this was an attack and not an accident?
Well, it would seem like it based on the explosion. I've met with some of our great generals, and they just seemed to feel that it was. This was not a manufacturing explosion type of event. This was a seems to be, according to them, they would know better than I would, but they seem to think it was a attack. It was a bomb of some kind, yes.
A bomb of some kind. Now, we know now that there was a Russian man who was the guy who apparently owned the shipment of ammonium nitrate, that the 2,700 tons of it, a guy named Igor Grashushkin. He was actually detained in Lebanon in 2013. Let me bring in Marie-Joëlle Zahara, political science professor, director of research network at Peace Operations at the Université de Montréal. Marie-Joëlle, first of all, great to have you on the program. Hope you and the fam are well. When you saw this explosion and then you heard the president of the United States say this seems to be an attack or a bomb of some kind, what did you think?
Honestly, rumors were swirling, and that is normal when something of that magnitude happens. I was not particularly convinced by the president of the United States because, honestly, it wouldn't be the first time he speaks before he has solid evidence, but also because as a political scientist and a specialist of Lebanon, Lebanese officials have often very quickly try to blame others for their failings. And that is a constant. Whenever there is an attack, it's either depending on, you know, the time and the political situation in the country, Israel or Syria or, you know, other dark forces that are blamed. This is the first time that security officials actually take responsibility. And the fact that there was ammonium nitrate seems to be, and I'm saying seems because we see evidence, but of course we haven't seen it with our own eyes. It seems to be actually verified by logs of the ships that were arrested for various failings at the port of Beirut back in 2013. That, of course, raises the question that you just posed, which is, if it was ammonium nitrate and it wasn't an attack, how come it was stored under such poor security protocols, and how would such a horrible thing be allowed to happen?
The Russian businessman who owned the ship that was apparently all this ammonium nitrate came on, the Rosas, which arrived in November of 2013 in Beirut, they're obviously trying to hold him accountable. But look, there are, what do you think of some of the, again, these are unverified. So let's just walk through them, because the official government, first there was, this is a fireworks factory. Everyone knew that was bogus. And that, then it's the ammonium nitrate. But could it just be a random, badly stored, thousands of tons, crazily stored in the port? Some have suggested that this is could be a munitions hidden behind that, part of a munitions dump or storage facility for Hezbollah, and that they talked about using ammonium-based bombs before. What do you make of those? Any credence to those ideas?
It is very difficult to really answer the question without any sort of evidence, because then we would be actually feeding the rumor mill. Of course, you know, the issue of holding the ship owner responsible is bogus, because if the ship was actually held at the port and its contents confiscated, then it's the responsibility of those who confiscated it, which is the Lebanese Port Authority, a public service, which depends directly on the Lebanese state, to ensure the safety of confiscated goods. Now, are there ammunition depots in Lebanon? Yes, there are. Why would one be at the harbor, which is a pretty public area? I mean, there are arguments for and against that. It would make these ammunition depots very visible to all kinds of people who go to the harbor, including, I would note, UN peacekeepers who actually had a ship docked at the harbor and who had casualties during the explosion yesterday. So, I mean, I don't think that Hezbollah would put ammunition in a place that is frequented by the UN and by a lot of people who are not necessarily all supporters. To my mind, for the time being, I think what is important is to ensure that there is some sort of inquiry into what happened and that responsibility is actually determined, because there are people who need to answer for this. I would also say that, sadly, given the state of Lebanon's bureaucracy, given the state of the state, of the Lebanese state, this kind of responsibility, inefficiency, would not be surprising.
There are other rumors that it was an attack by Israel. There's lots of rumors. And again, we've got to be very careful. We do not know. But Beirut's leveled. This is a country already, its economy was leveled before this explosion. COVID even doing even worse. I've just got a couple minutes. What will the consequences be? This is a region rife with instability since the civil war in the 80s. What could happen here? What are you watching for?
I'm watching socioeconomically for the risk of famine, which was already quite high on the radar of international organizations because of the socioeconomic collapse. Right. And because of the fact that half of Lebanon's population has actually fallen below the poverty level. So that is the first thing that I would be watching for. I'm also watching for the impact this will have on migration. A lot of people have given up on Lebanon. But if Lebanon had one thing going for it, it is its human resources. It is the Lebanese people who made the country live and survive above and beyond. Will this be, you know, something that gives them the cause for despair? And I'm also watching on the impact this will have on mobilizations. You were talking to my colleague, Efinasian, earlier on, and he said that he expected mobilizations to actually start all over again and people to ask for answers. I think that that might actually give them a second wind, particularly as, you know, the demonstrations that had been, you know, right, really pressuring the government had actually died down under the combined weight of the pandemic, right, and socioeconomic collapse.
Well, listen, I really think we needed to hear somebody who understands this situation more than on a surface level, and you've given us that. Marie-Joëlle Zahar from the Université de Montréal, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time as we watch the fallout of this devastating blast in Beirut in Lebanon, and our hearts go out to that city.
Sorting through the changes, here's Evan Solomon.
It is time for our weekly regular segment with our friend Scott Reed, CTV political analyst, former director of communications for Paul Martin. It is, and he's not either overhyped or underplayed, he's just right. It is overhyped versus underplayed.
Overhyped.
Great jobs and opportunity.
In this election,
here's what I want to do.
Or underplayed.
Hello, Mr. Reed.
Hello. That was a very Goldilocks introduction. I felt like, you know, there were going to be three bears that jump out at me because my porridge is neither too cold nor too hot nor hyped or undersold.
You know, a lot of people used to call you the Goldilocks of politics.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, well, it's because of my curls. But anyway, we're getting off on a tangent.
We are. Yeah. By the way, throughout this pandemic, I've been decided, folks, on a personal on my Facebook page, which has like one follower. I think it's Scott. That I was publishing a few sort of pandemic poems that I've wrote, and I, you know, thought, oh, I'm going to just go out there on a limb. And the very first person that commented was my pal Scott Reed, and he immediately chastised me for lacking sex in my poems. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, poetry is nothing if not some veiled Victorian torturous way to communicate about the act of fornication, and your poems lack it, and that's a consequence. They're soulless.
Wow, that hurts me deeply. I mean,
I'm
happily
kidding. You're
married.
Actually a very good writer. It drives me crazy, and it fills me with rage.
I love that. I gotta say, it was the best response I got. I love it. There's nothing I like more than Mr. Reed. Scott Reed, let's do Overhyped and Underplayed on the real things. Today's topic, we just were joined by the Public Procurement Services and Procurement Minister, Anita Anand, who said that the government's announced two big contracts with two drug companies to get some vaccines, but millions of vaccines potentially for next year. Here's what she told us.
These agreements with Moderna and Pfizer are indicative of our aggressive approach to secure access to vaccine candidates now, so that Canadians are at the front of the line when a vaccine becomes available.
Overhyped or underplayed? We have no idea if these things are going to work. What's your sense?
I think it's overhyped. And I'll be crystal clear, I hope, in what I mean by that. I don't think this announcement is overhyped. It's a good announcement. And by the way, she's like a sleeper minister, eh? This woman, she's just like quietly confident, which, you know, it's worth its weight in gold in politics. Trust me, I've worked in the prime minister's office. But, you know, there are a million news stories. All you have to do is walk to your front stoop, yell the word vaccine, and a group of reporters will show up and faithfully record everything you say. And so I think we're moving into silly season phase on the issue of vaccines. We're very early talking about trials. You see, some people are complaining, I can't get this. I want Health Canada approval. They're not giving me human trials. I need this from some other country. China's blocking me. It feels to me like we are moving into a breathless phase when it comes to discussion and reporting on vaccines.
It's overhyped, but in this case, I would say this is justifiably overhyped. And here's my reason. Speaking to Dr. Peter Singer, a senior doctor at the WHO,
a good friend of mine,
who told us yesterday, Canadian, 165 candidates for a vaccine around the world, only 10% will work. So you're right. It's overhyped. We don't know if Pfizer, Moderna, we don't know if these are going to work or not. There's a 90% chance they don't. But the reason it's legitimately overhyped is you got to put some chips on the table, because Canadians will not get access to a vaccine unless we pay up front. Every country's doing it. You got to put your money up, because if this thing hits, this is the big lottery, and Canadians don't have any money on the table, we're not in the lineup to get these things, we are screwed. So the minister is right to make this bet.
I know this isn't supposed to be the vaccines commercial, but I got it. To me, your point highlights something that I think is really troubling. Really, really, really troubling. And Peter Singer is a friend of mine. He's working at the WHO. You know, spoke a little bit about that, I think, yesterday. I've certainly known that he's raised it before. And that is, we need international agreement, and notionally it exists through the WHO, on equitable international sharing of vaccines when they become available. Like this idea of, you know, if Trump can get to the Germans first, or if, you know, somebody signs up, they get first in line. Like, that's not the world in which we ought to live. That's the movie Contagion. That's not the way to do it. Let's do this rationally. It is the definition of a public good, and it ought to be treated as such, and there ought to be binding national agreements on this so that internationally we do this thing the right way.
I could not agree more with you, but scarcity creates tension. Scarcity, the pandemic politics is so urgent. We know it is an absolute war to get PPE, and if the war for PPE was hot, wait till you get the vaccine. There will be an absolute tremendous pressure. I agree with you. We need international agreements. but we're tearing down those institutions. Number two, a Léger poll out says that 50% of Canadians say if Justin Trudeau is found guilty of another ethics violation, which would be the hat trick, the trifecta, over the We Charity scandal, we need an election ASAP. Overhyped or underplayed?
Overhyped. I think any election discussion is overhyped. People may answer the question that way, and that may prove to be, and it points to a vulnerability for the government. But ultimately, every time this question has been asked, every which way, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and the public has indicated they do not wish to be doused with partisanship. And so I think if you ask that question nine more times, 10 people will tell you, no. We actually don't want an election. And I think it would be very dangerous for the opposition to push for an election. I think it would be very dangerous for the government to get the scent in their nostrils and push for an election. Take care of the public business right now. It's just too unpredictable.
Yeah, my sense is, though, I don't think an election in the fall would be terrible. One, it's a minority government. Two, they need a mandate to spend what are hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that they never got a mandate for. It's a new world. The election last time is almost an irrelevant result of what we want to do. I don't think the We scandal and controversy is necessarily existential threat to the government, but I think it's a very deep pain. They're hurt badly by it. How long it lasts, I don't know. But I don't think it's crazy to seek another mandate, and I don't think we should necessarily always say, and I think the Liberals have made a mistake on this, always suggest that any kind of functioning democratic exercise is somehow taking our eye off the ball in the pandemic. You know, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. And in this case, walking is our democracy. I just got a minute here. Reopening schools is a big question in Ontario. Doug Ford's talking about that. I'll just say where I am on this one, Scotty. It is always underplayed, the most important political decision for any politician.
Absolutely underplayed. And it's being particularly underplayed here in Ontario. This decision, people can talk about, well, it's been a different Doug Ford. We really like what we've seen. This is the test. This is the single test. I've got a 7-year-old going into grade 4. I don't know if I'm going to let the kid go to school. At this moment in time, based on the information I have, the doubts that are lingering, I'll wait to hear more from the school and from the school board. But at this time, based on this plan, I'm not sure I'm comfortable putting my kid back in a public school classroom. Just am not sure. So government has got to do better. And this, big as this story is, it's still way underplayed.
Yeah, I totally agree with Scott. And as I got two kids in the system, too. I'm like any parent out there listening. We're hanging on by our fingernails, and we just don't know. It's white knuckle time. Scott Reed, I know you got to go. I appreciate your time. But if you want to stick around, we've got a representative, Steve Smith from New Hampshire, who just has the Jetsons bill. They're going to register your flying car. That's right. The flying car.
Evan Solomon Show is brought to you by TheraBreath Mouthwash and Toothpaste. Find a store near you at TheraBreathCanada.com.
Do you remember the Jetsons? Do you remember this theme song from the Jetsons?
Meet George Jetson.
1960s, the dream, the Jetsons' dream, George Jetson in the flying car. How long have you wanted a flying car? Well, guess what? In New Hampshire, license plates, live free or die, they might live very, very free because they are going to start, I don't know, licensing flying cars? Why? Let's find out. The New Hampshire Representative Stephen Smith joins us. Representative Smith, great to have you on our program across Canada.
Thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of what is this business, the what's known as the Jetson Bill?
Yeah, not a moniker I came up with. There are a few companies that are pretty close to having a product that you can buy. It's a small airplane. You land it, the wings fold up, and you drive it like a car. Off you go.
So what are you guys doing in New Hampshire about that?
Well, the they're certified by the FAA, as safe aircraft. The problem is you fly into the airport, you land, how do you legally drive it out of the gate? So we had to come up with licensing rules for them. Do you put license plates on them? How do we identify them? What do we accept as an inspection safety certificate? And the bill worked all that out, and it went surprisingly well. It went through unanimously.
So there's one thing. I guess there's a plane called the Switchblade, right? Which is like this three-wheeled. It looks like a car, but it folds its wings out and it flies, right?
Yes. And then you have the Terrafugia, which looks like a bizarre-looking car when it lands, a different configuration. And then there's the PAL V.
So how common are these things?
Oh, not at all yet. One of the companies is expecting their certification to be able to sell them. So if you've got the money, you can buy one in 2021. So they have working prototypes that are being tested right now.
Have you been in one?
No, I haven't. I couldn't score that. I tried.
Yeah, I bet you did, man. Representative Smith from New Hampshire. So New Hampshire's going to legalize flying cars. How does it work? Like, you still have to fly from an airport. It's not like, you know what? Crap, I'm stuck in traffic. Spread the wings out. I'm taking off.
Oh, if only. No. No, we included in the bill that they have to land and take off from an actual airstrip.
Okay, so it's not like... So you got to land at a legal airport, and then when you're driving one of these things, I'm looking at some pictures of these flying cars. I mean, the wings are folded up. Like, can they really drive on the road as if it's a car?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, one of the first questions I asked was, well, so you have to fuel it at the airport, but they actually run on unleaded gas. So you drive one of these in the gas station, put the same gas in that you put in your car today.
And so would it be, so let's say I'm like, you know what, I got to land on this country road, and I'm just going to land, like, do you get a ticket? What's the ticket if you don't land at a proper airport?
Well, there's standard tickets for motor vehicle infractions, so that one would probably be, I don't know if I'm going to get this right, probably around $100. Hopefully nobody thinks that's well worth it.
It's worth it to me to try that. Yeah. Well, is there federal oversight here? Like, does the federal government say, okay, hey, New Hampshire, I get to live free or die. You guys don't like a lot of oversight over there. But, hey, man, you're not licensing flying cars until we do this federally.
No. Interestingly, there's two agencies there. You have the FAA that certifies things to be aircraft that you can use and then does the oversight for safety. They have to go through an extremely stringent yearly inspection, and you know that's true of all aircraft. And then on the flip side, to be able to drive it on the roads, they need authorization from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which certifies all surface transport vehicles here. So we've provided the framework for them to be able to throw a plate on this thing and drive it out of Manchester Airport, but they're still not going to be able to sell them to people until they get those two certifications.
Right. What's the future like now that New Hampshire's done this? I mean, are we talking about people owning flying cars when? As early as when? And how much would they be?
2021, and I could be wrong, but I believe they were around $500,000 and up. So you're in, like, you know, Bugatti territory there. So really expensive cars.
Let's just say you've just licensed it for like six people.
Yeah. Some of the applications that were discussed, though, I worked for a tech company for 10 years that had people flying about the country. So you got some overhead there. They land at the airport. You have to pick them up. You have to drive them. Perhaps a company might buy one of these things, and people could just fly from New Hampshire to California. You'd need a couple of stops. I think the range is only... I actually don't know what the range is. But once you're there, you fold the wings up and drive off to your hotel, be done with it.
It's kind of crazy. It's super expensive. I guess you need a pilot's license and a driver's license, right?
Correct. You can't fly it unless you're a pilot, and you can't drive it on our roads anyway without a driver's license. They're expensive, but this is an emerging market. I'm old enough to remember $2,000 VCRs, you know? So if they take off, that was a bad pun. I'm sure that the price would come down through economy of scale.
Yeah, I'm sure they would. Like, there's no way that the price doesn't come down. But if it's only legal in New Hampshire next year, if I buy my flying car in New Hampshire and I want to fly to New York, it ain't legal there. I guess you can only travel to New Hampshire right now.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? So the bill kind of makes us a destination if anybody has one and wants to drive it around.
I guess so, you can drive to New Hampshire, then fly around the state airspace, and then come down and drive out of New Hampshire. That's the key, right?
Oh, sure. You're a New Yorker, or you live in Connecticut, and you want to come up here to go skiing or enjoy the lakes, and you own one of these things at your local small airport. You just take your bags over there, get in, but when you fly up here, you don't need a rental. You can just drive your plane to the hotel or Lake Winnipesaukee.
If you can afford $500,000 car, you probably are not too worried about accommodations either.
Yeah. You're probably driving it to your house on Lake Winnipesaukee.
Yeah, that's right. You've probably got your driver and your pilot to do it. So these things are crazy looking. I guess the vision is at one point there's just going to be a whole whack of flying cars out there.
That's, well, goal for the future. I don't know how far out that is. But, I mean, yeah, talk about traffic mitigation. I used to live on Long Island, and we were sentenced to the world's longest parking lot, the Long Island Expressway. And what would it have been worth then for people that needed to have meetings in Manhattan to fly over all those cars sitting there for 3 hours, just go right by at 150 miles an hour?
Well, it would cost you about $500,000.
It would.
I don't think we know what it would. Well, listen.
Well, worth
this,
it over 20 or 30 years, huh?
Yeah. Well, maybe, I don't know, maybe these become taxis. This is the thing. You take your taxi,
yeah.
and this is the new Uber Air. I'm sure they'll be in the air. Listen, Representative Smith, great to have you on our program. This is great to have the Jetsons bill finally come into reality. Thanks for giving us a little peek into the future.
Oh, no problem. Happy to be on. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, appreciate it. That's New Hampshire Representative Stephen Smith. The person behind the Jetsons bill. Would you take a flying? I mean, the price is way too high. But how cool is that? These pictures are crazy. All right, that does it for us today. I mean, you know, we cover everything you want, plus we give you a peek at the flying cars in the future. I think that's cool. I think I like when politicians have a nose for the future. Maybe flying cars, the price got to come down. Keep listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network.